It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Did you know that in 1958, the U.S. Air Force investigated setting off a nuclear weapon on the moon? Did you know that in the 1960s, the CIA tried to make a covert listening device out of a house cat? Well, these and many other incredible accounts are found in the book Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince Houghton is the author of the book. He's an intelligence historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. He joins us today. Vince Houghton, welcome to the program.
Hey, nice to be here. Thank you.
It's interesting. You've researched and written about all these missions, schemes, weapons that were planned and tested, but never executed. Before we get into some of these fantastic stories, expand on the first sentence that you have in your book. It reads, "This book is about desperation."
So these stories were specifically chosen during the Second World War and the Cold War, mainly because this is the only time in our history as a nation where we had a true existential threat since the Civil War, really. And so the 20th century, specifically the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, was a time in which our existence was under potential threat, whether it was from the Nazis or the Imperial Japanese or from the 65,000 nuclear weapons the Soviets were pointing at us. And because of that threat, people were willing to act out of true desperation in ways they never would otherwise. And sometimes desperation leads to really impressive innovations. GPS, the internet, you know, some of the inventions during the Second World War, like the atomic bomb and radar. Some of the extraordinary inventions during the Cold War, like the space program. There's a lot of books written about these. That's not me. I care less about those things. Those are the great things that came out of this desperate time. I really wanted to focus on the ideas that were so far out of the box that they are extraordinary in the sense that we want to knee-jerk react to these, like, what were they thinking? And that's fine. That's a great question to ask. I just want people to ask it a different way. I want people to ask it, what were they thinking? Mm. Like, what was the motivation behind this? Like, what fears were they under? Like, how were they so desperate to do something, anything, to keep America fighting in the Second World War and to keep America ahead, or at least even with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, that they were willing to come up with these ideas? Because it's so easy for us in 2019 to look back at these and think these are ridiculous, silly plans. That does nothing for us. It doesn't teach us anything historically. The only thing that does is trying to put ourselves in the shoes of these people and try to understand why, on a normal day, these were really good scientists and good inventors and good engineers. And for whatever reason, they went down a path that we kind of laugh at today, but at the time made a ton of sense.
Okay, let's get acquainted with the acoustic kitty. This is a covert listening device from a poor house cat, and this was something that was actually carried out, tested.
Well, yeah, and the funny part, that was the actual official name of the program, too. So somebody at CIA had a sense of humor. This was in the 1960s, and the CIA had been struggling with coming up with effective covert listening devices, you know, euphemistically called bugs. It wasn't that they weren't picking up enough sound. It's that they were picking up way too much sound. Bugs picked up everything. There was no way to really filter out the important stuff with 1960s-era technology. So the CIA decided, what if we can't get the bug right up to the conversation that we want to be heard and do it in such a way that the person has no idea he's being listened to? But better way to do that is to implant it in an animal that if it walked up to you on the street and kind of sat down, you wouldn't pay it a second bit of attention. In fact, if you like cats, maybe you can let it jump up on your lap and sit there and you'd scratch it behind the ear, not realizing that it's a CIA agent that's listening into your top secret conversation. So in the 1960s, they actually went through with doing a surgical procedure on a cat. They opened it up. They put a power pack inside its abdomen. They wired up the microphone inside of its ear canal and wired the antenna down into its tail. And amazingly, the technology worked. the actual listening device part of the Acoustic Kitty worked perfectly. The problem was, and everyone will kind of laugh at this when I say this, is you actually have to train the cat to do what we want it to actually go and listen to the conversations we want to listen to. And anyone who's spent more than 10 seconds around a cat,
right,
when they hear the phrase train the cat, they already know what went bad.
Ain't gonna happen, training a cat. Right. But, we think about the welfare. I mean, all the cat lovers, myself included, the welfare of the cats that were experimented on here. But that's a part of history more than just this experimental program.
Yeah, and I mean, I cringe when I literally wrote this chapter like with my cat sitting on my lap.
Mm.
And so I was like, sorry, Elwood, I have to write this chapter because it's just this interesting part of history. And one of the interesting things is one of the stories from CIA is that they took really good care of these cats. And I know they didn't get a chance to really volunteer for this experiment, but they did it in a surgical suite. They had a veterinarian do it under anesthesia. You know, they didn't, like, dispose of the cat afterwards. They took care of it. But, yes, it's certainly not our finest hour in taking care of animals.
Let's jump to the part of the book. It's a section you call Fun with Nuclear Weapons. The idea of using nuclear weapons for peaceful purposes, nuking the moon was only, one of them, but also disrupting a hurricane. Give us an overview of how, at one time, nuclear weapons were seen as something that we could use for more than just war.
Well, there's a program that was in the 1960s and 70s called the Plowshare Program, which was an attempt by scientists who realized you couldn't put the genie back in the bottle, that nuclear weapons were here to stay. So maybe we can find better ways to use them than just to, you know, annihilate all life on Earth. And one of the ideas came from a meteorologist who had been working with the early bomb testing. If you've seen videos from, like, the Bikini Islands and the big bombs in the Pacific, he had been out there, and he looked at them and said, man, the power of these weapons is extraordinary. And the altitude at which they explode is extraordinary. I wonder if we could explode a nuclear weapon in the eye of a hurricane and somehow break up the rotation enough to weaken the hurricane. Now,
brilliant idea.
That, sure, except that a hurricane has the power of like 100,000 nuclear weapons in it.
Okay.
But Plan B was actually one that might work. Plan B for him was, what if we could detonate a nuclear weapon on the outside of a hurricane and try to redirect it, kind of mess with the spin a little bit enough that we can push it, in this case, out into the ocean so that it doesn't actually hit landfall.
Mm.
And to me, I'm a South Floridian. To me, that sounds like a great idea. I've lived through 12 hurricanes. I'd love to never live through another one again. And if that worked, wonderful. The problem for Reed was that the only way to actually test this was to do it.
Yeah.
And if it fails, if it doesn't turn the hurricane, all of a sudden, not only do you have like a category 4 hurricane, but it's a category 4 hurricane swirling with radioactive debris at 200 miles an hour. And that could be really problematic for people who are in the path of the hurricane.
Could it? Could, okay, theoretically, we will hopefully never, ever test this, and this will be in the archive of our history of bad ideas. Do you think it could have worked?
Well, what's funny is NOAA, so the government organization that focuses on weather and everything else, NOAA has their website, NOAA.gov, has a frequently asked questions page in which they answer questions about lightning strikes and about, you know, weather patterns and thunderstorms. Well, one of the ones they have on there is, could we use nuclear weapons to disrupt hurricanes? And they say, no, for the love of God, no. They stop asking this question. No, we can't do that. It just doesn't work. But what's interesting to me is that the frequently part of frequently asked questions, which means that there's a lot of people out there that are asking this question today about whether or not nuclear weapons could be used. And the answer is no, absolutely not. This is not – the power of a hurricane is just way, way too high. Nature is so much more powerful than anything that we can stand up and try to do that we might as well just call it a day. Nature's going to win in the end.
Vince Houghton is my guest. His new book looks at intelligence and military schemes, thankfully left on the drawing board, mission schemes and weapons that were planned and tested but never executed. Vince is an intelligence historian, also curator of the International Spy Museum in our nation's capital. Let's talk about this 1958 instance where the Air Force investigated setting off a nuclear weapon on the moon. Why would you do that?
Well, this is in the wake of the Sputnik launch in 1957, where the Soviets put the first ever artificial anything into space. And the problem was, not only did they launch it into space on the top of a rocket that would be used later on to deliver nuclear weapons potentially to the United States, but they beat us at our own game. We had always been the innovators when it came to science and technology. The United States was the vanguard, the leader in the world that everyone else looked up to for science. And all of a sudden, the Soviets had taken that from us. And so in 1958, we were desperate to do something, anything, to try to convince the world that we were the big kids on the block. So the idea came down through the Air Force of, like, what if we detonate a thermonuclear weapon on the moon, in which case the whole world will see that the Americans still have it, that we're still the leaders in science and technology. And it was essentially, that was the reason for it. It was a propaganda effect. It was, you know, let's demonstrate to the world that they should be following us and not the Soviets.
Now, Carl Sagan figures in here somehow. How does he work his way in?
Yeah, so the Air Force actually, they hired a man named Leonard Riefel to lead this program. And Riefel was a polymath. He was good at a lot of things. He was somebody who had worked with Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago, Fermi being one of the Manhattan Project scientists. After this program, he goes on to be the deputy director of the Apollo program. So this is somebody who is a hardcore, real scientist. And actually, if you're a sports fan out there, he also invented the telestrator, which is, you know, drawing the lines and the plays on the screen. So this is somebody who was not some crackpot scientist at the basement of the Pentagon. And he brought in two men to help him with his operation. One was a guy named Gerard Kuiper. And Kuiper was an astronomer who had discovered the Kuiper Belt, which is a belt of ice and rocks outside of Neptune. So this is a guy who had done some huge scientific innovation. And Kuiper brought with him a grad student to do math. Right, there's going to be a ton of math involved in this project to kind of figure out what the explosion on the moon would look like and everything else. And that grad student was none other than Carl Sagan, who didn't even have his PhD yet, was still working through school, and was brought on to be part of this program.
And what was his view of nuking the moon?
Well, they were all for it. I mean, all of these people were totally bought into this idea. Now, in a lot of cases, they came up with, they justified the program in different ways. Very few of them wanted to think that they were being used for a purely propaganda mission. So for Sagan, if he detonated a nuclear weapon on the moon, maybe it could kind of tell you a little bit about the early existence of maybe life on the moon. You know, Sagan was a big proponent of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So maybe there'd be kind of subatomic particles or even some fossils, like underneath the moon. You can build this huge crater and see what was under there. That, if that's true or not, fine. That comes out much, much later. So I don't know what he was thinking in 1958, other than, hey, this is a cool job that I'm going to get paid to do. For Leonard Riefel, the program manager, I think that he saw this as a way to look at the geology of the moon and try to investigate the properties. Just we hadn't been there yet. We didn't know a whole lot about it. And so these scientists, on one hand, were looking at real scientific possibilities. On the other hand, they were all patriotic Americans. They all understood that it was important for the big picture Cold War to be able to convince especially the developing world, talking Latin America, Africa, East Asia, that we're looking toward the United States and the Soviet Union, trying to figure out, what guy am I going to follow? What side am I going to choose? And so a lot of it was propaganda. And so a lot of these scientists understood that even if a program like this didn't have a whole lot of scientific value, it could matter in the long run.
Talking about missions, schemes, and weapons that were planned and tested on behalf of the U.S. but never executed, my guest, Vince Houghton, Nuking the Moon, is his book. Let's talk a little bit about, well, go back to World War II. Talk about this project aimed at winning the war in the Pacific against the Japanese with bats with bombs attached.
Yeah, and this program actually makes a ton of sense, and I think it may have worked if it was allowed to. You know, we all learn in elementary school that bats during the day will strive to find a warm, dark, and dry place to kind of hold up during the daylight hours. And in many cases, if it, you know, it comes inside your house, it'll go up to an attic or an easement or a nook and cranny and kind of hide out there until it gets dark. Well, Japan has a bunch of houses and buildings that have attics and nooks and crannies and easements. And Japan is also a country in the 1940s built out of mostly wood and paper. So if you have bats that will naturally go to attics and easements and nooks and crannies inside buildings, and the bats are fitted with a small incendiary device, eventually a little napalm bomb, when they're dropped over Japan, they will basically burn that country to the ground. So it's a simple concept. Bats plus bombs plus attics plus wooden houses equal the war ends. And they tested it. They tested it multiple times, and it actually worked as a proof of concept. And they were ready to get full funding in the summer of 1945, unfortunately for them. It took them that long to figure out how to make this work. And they went to the Chief of Naval Operations, because this is a Navy program, and said, yeah, we need a bunch of $1 million to go kind of do this bat bomb program that's going to end the war. And Ernest King, who was the CNO at the time, said, what are you guys talking about? Why would I give you money? There's a top secret program happening in New Mexico right now that's going to end the war much, much faster than your bat bombs ever will. Mm. And, of course, he was talking about the atomic bombs that had been built around the same time. So this is a concept that actually doesn't fail. This is not a book full of failures. This is a book full of programs that never get a chance to fail. In this case, bat bombs may have worked.
Right.
They just were superseded by the atomic bombs.
As you bring out in the book, it was tested in a fake Japanese village in California, in the Californian desert in 1943. 3,500 bats with napalm bombs attached to them.
And it burned the village to the ground. It worked as good as you could possibly hope that would work. And, yeah, I mean, this was a proof of concept that made a ton of sense. And the man who was behind this, the inventor behind this, swore to his death decades later that this actually would have been a way to win the war by killing far less Japanese than the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So many of your instances here of these schemes and plots that were abandoned for whatever reason because they didn't work, or because something upstaged them, as in this case, make you think, Vince, that what might have been? Ask that question on a number of instances. Did researching and writing this book give you pause a number of times to think what might have been?
Yes, but there's a big part of being a historian that kind of wants to force me to not think that way. The counterfactuals, the what-ifs, mm-hmm. are things that I try to avoid as much as I possibly can as a historian, because it's fun to do, like, in a bar at 2 a.m., you know, where you're kind of chatting with your friends about, like, what could have happened if. But it doesn't do us a lot of good as historians to look at the outcome of things and base our judgment on that and that alone. It's unfair from 2019 to look back at these programs based on the fact that the Cold War ended without anyone really dying in major ways, certainly not a nuclear exchange. And World War II ended with a victory for the Allies. And so we look back at it in hindsight, the outcome version of history, and it's kind of unfair to look at the what-ifs because we know the ending. It's much more, to me, it's much more educational and much more enlightening as a historian to look at these and ignore the endings completely and just put ourselves in the shoes of the actors and put ourselves in the shoes of those making the decisions at the time. And so I don't really care about the what-if question. Mm. I want to actually kind of avoid that as much as I can. I just want to kind of walk through this and understand why people who are seemingly normal human beings, in many cases are incredibly accomplished people, are willing to contemplate, not just contemplate, to research, to advocate for, to try to put into practice ideas that today seem absolutely ridiculous.
Vince, we have to take a break in just a moment. We've got a minute or so. Perhaps in that minute you can tell us, how did you select these stories? Which ones? Because you have 20-some in this book. I imagine there are plenty more that you had to choose from. What criteria did these have to meet?
Well, the criteria was that they had to be something that really showcased the desperate thinking of the people at the time. That would, to me, that would never have been contemplated had the time period not been so threatening, had there not been this existential threat hanging over the heads of those at the time. And in many cases, I chose them because they were, in my opinion, some of them were the most ridiculous and fun stories. So it's a mixture of a kind of a real reason, the idea that this is really, would truly show desperation, but also because these are just amazing stories, and kind of bringing those two together in what I consider kind of the Goldilocks package of just right is what you get from the 21 chapters in this book.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, who did you interview, top of the list, some of the people actually involved in these experiments, these plots?
Yeah, every chance I could to actually talk to a real person, I did. And one of the great things that the International Spy Museum allows me to do is it puts me around all these people and allows me to have contact with some of the most, certainly the people of the last several decades working at CIA or other agencies around the world. I was able to talk to them and be like, all right, let's talk about the real story behind this now that you can a little bit.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with Vince Houghton, Nuking the Moon, his book, and Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Let's get back to, well, your chapter on here, Vince, fascinating, on psychological operations and some of those that were thought of but never let loose. What's at the top of the list in this PSYOPs section?
Yeah, so this is, I love this chapter, Project Fantasia, which was an attempt to really dive into the psyche of the Japanese soldier. And you never, ever would see this if it wasn't for how much desperation we felt to try to win the war in the Pacific, because this really taps into some of the deep-seated racism and ethnocentrism in the United States toward the Japanese. The problem was that they weren't surrendering. And if you looked at the Pacific War during World War II, you realize that many of the Japanese soldiers fought to the death, to the last man. And we were winning, but it was somewhat of a Pyrrhic victory. If we were losing thousands and thousands of soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen every time we took another Japanese island. So the idea was, can we create a psychological operation, a PSYOP, that would act as a force multiplier, that would maybe make the Japanese soldier run away or quit before the fighting actually happened? And they weren't afraid of the U.S. Marine, but maybe they would be afraid based on their religion, in this case, Shinto. And within Shintoism, the fox plays a integral role. In some cases, the fox is a good omen. It's a positive spirit. In a lot of cases, though, the fox is a bad guy. It's an evil spirit or a mischievous spirit that is the reason that the OSS and the military decided to try to take advantage of that. So Fantasia called for applying luminescent paint to foxes. Essentially, we're going to spray paint them with glow-in-the-dark paint and then send them ahead of our forces to try to scare the Japanese away. Because in their mind, they would be seeing glowing spirit foxes running at them. And they, Marines aren't that scary, but maybe glowing spirit foxes will be.
Wow.
And they would run away and drop their weapons and refuse to fight. On face, it's not the worst idea. Maybe you can get some of them to run away. Maybe you can create mass hysteria.
Right.
The kind of problem they ran into was the logistical, unless you're going to airdrop the foxes onto the islands, which would be great, but that wasn't the plan, they would have to get there the same way the Marines would, and that means amphibiously, and which meant wading through water and swimming up onto the beaches. 1940s technology, it's great that we created glow-in-the-dark paint, but no one had created waterproof glow-in-the-dark paint quite yet. And so the best laid plans would have been washed off with the foxes as they waded up to the beaches. They would no longer be glow-in-the-dark. They would just be regular-looking foxes. It was none other than General Douglas MacArthur that kind of mentioned this. It had gone through testing and recruitment phase, and they collected a bunch of foxes, and lots of people within the military thought this was a great idea. And then Doug MacArthur came and said, "Won't all the paint wash off?" And that was everyone was like, "Oh yeah," but yeah. So it a lot of wasted money on that one.
Well, maybe psychological operations is a good tie into today when we ask about what any of these schemes and plots and plans that were abandoned could mean for today. Because as you mentioned in the book, you know, we think about, oh, it's laughable that Japanese would be scared away by glowing foxes. But we, as you point out in the book, we had Russian intelligence convince a good number of Americans that there was a child sex slave operation being run out of a Washington, D.C. pizza joint.
Yeah, I mean, the psychological operations are used a lot because they work. You know, this is not something that people would continue to try to use if it was useless. And if you know your enemy well enough, in this case, the Russians understood the American divide over politics, and the American divide over, you know, left versus right, and were able to exploit that. And they exploited that in the 2016 election better than probably anyone has in the history of covert action. We thought we knew the Japanese. We thought we knew the Japanese because of our deep-seated racism for the Japanese. So it's not necessarily likely it would have been as successful because the Japanese were not this backward people. The Japanese were not, you know, this, you know, bumpkin society of superstitious people. They had actually built technologies that were way better than American technologies. We just kind of wanted to ignore that. So I don't. It may have worked. We never know. We know that we had to avoid the what-ifs, the counterfactuals. But in this case, it never got a chance to. It never got off the drawing board.
Vince, before we go, I'd like to ask you, as the curator of the International Spy Museum, give us a quick view of some of the exhibits and artifacts of espionage that you have there in Washington.
So the International Spy Museum has the largest collection of intelligence artifacts on display anywhere in the world. And it's everything from the gadgets you would expect that were created by CIA or KGB or the British or anyone else to help intelligence officers do their job, covert communications, covert photography, escape and evasion, but also one-of-a-kind historic artifacts from the ice axe that killed Leon Trotsky in Mexico City back during the early Cold War to a Stinger missile that was used to shoot down a Soviet helicopter in Afghanistan by the Mujahideen in the 1980s and then given back to CIA, to a lot of the really one-of-a-kind artifacts from the mission to rescue the six American, we call them the house guests from Iran, that was depicted in the movie Argo. If you remember that movie, we have all the artifacts from that, to a lot of the operations that caught spies and the artifacts from some of the most, for American perspective, one of the most devious and infamous spies like Robert Hansen and Aldrich Ames and people like John Walker. Across the board, if you, anything even remotely involved with intelligence or even in some cases special operations, we have it in the museum. We've been around since 2002, so there's a long tradition that we've developed now of being a museum that people take seriously, but also one that you can go and have fun at. So we're pretty proud of it. We've just reopened, actually, a new and better building in L'Enfant Plaza in Southwest D.C. We've actually only been open for a short time period, so come and check us out if you come to D.C. anytime in the future.
Okay, Vince Houghton, historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington. His book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, what a pleasure to have you on the program today. Thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.